Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Captain Dave Bitters, and he'll be answering your most important questions on stripers on the Massachusetts coast. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Dave Bitters about stripers on the Massachusetts coast. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Dave, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. In our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Dave's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers. Front Range Anglers is in Boulder, Colorado. Their website is www.frontrangeanglers.com. And if you should win this gift certificate, you can redeem it in their store or online in their online store as well. So here's how you can win that $20 gift certificate. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something Dave and I talked about during the show. So you must submit your answer along with your name, location, in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win that $20 gift certificate. Tonight, our guest is Captain Dave Bitters. Dave has had a diversified career over the past 30 years. While a student at Huntington University, he worked as the assistant to the professor of ornithology. And after graduation, he worked 2 years as a photo lab manager and shortly thereafter launched his career as a commercial photographer specializing in people, product, fashion, and aerial photography. His work has been published worldwide in editorial markets, and he has done assignment work for numerous corporations. In 1994, Bitters started guiding fishing and hunting clients on the side while still handling photo assignments. He soon discovered guiding was another one of his passions and earned his USCG captain's license and started Damon Guide Service, Inc. Running two companies kept him very busy doing what he loved most. During this time, Captain Dave started writing about the outdoors for several magazines and also completed his first book, Doors to the Outdoors. Most recently, Dave has launched Damon Productions, a film company specializing in outdoors adventure. He is currently producing a national television show called The Bayman Life with Captain Dave and Gianna, a reality-based series about men and women who make their living in recreation on the bays up and down the New England coast. Well, Dave, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thanks a lot, Roger. Good to be here.
Well, good to have you, and hope everybody's treating you well out there. And
I can't complain.
Can't complain, huh? Good. Well, we've got lots of questions tonight, and stripers are always a popular topic for our folks and always an exciting fish to go after. So let's see if we can't educate me as well as my audience here and teach us a little bit more about the stripers on the Massachusetts coast. So let's start with that. Let's start with a little geography lesson. And why don't you describe the coastline that you fish most often there and take your clients out to, and what kind of distance it is and what part of the coast it encompasses?
You bet. You know, I guide 25 square miles. That's my home territory waters down here on Plymouth Bay, Massachusetts. And we have a variety of structure. We have a lot of flats. But let me first say that our tidal changes are twice a day, and they're between 9 feet and 12 feet every 6 hours. So we have those twice a day, but all the water in the bay empties out, and the only water left in the bay are these narrow little channels and guzzles. Some of them are quite deep, most of them are quite shallow, and the average depth across our bay at high tide is 15 feet of water. We have flats similar to what they have in Florida that keep, you know, anywhere from 6 inches to 2 or 3 feet of water on top of them. But that really depends on the tide fluctuation, the moon phase, and the time of year. We can have a real drainer, and we can lose 12, 13 feet of water in 6 hours on the bay, which is pretty amazing. And then all the flats are exposed on a drainer, and then when the tide comes back in, they start to flood, and fish tend to come up on the flats and start chasing bait fish and grubbing for crabs. So the flats are one of our main fishing areas that we target, and it's primarily sight fishing. Other areas that we fish are the deeper channels, the deeper guzzles that hold water at all tides, and they can range from, 7 feet to maybe 24 feet, depending on where we are in the bay. The majority of our bay is pretty flat. We don't have a lot of big rocky structures like you see maybe off, say, Nantucket. So up here, we have what we call microstructure. A microstructure is just small areas on the bay that hold a handful of fish at any given tide. So if you know when the water's moved over those areas, over that structure, you can target fish if you know what the tides are and what time the tide is going to be covering over a certain piece of structure on the bay. And the bass will be hanging on the downward side of that where the tide washes over, brings bait over it. Could have rocks, you could have eelgrass beds. We have some very large eelgrass beds here. Could be just a bump in the flat itself that's causing the water to wash over and creating a little lee on the back side of it. And then some areas we have are actual big boulders the size of an automobile, and we have some boulder fields that are fairly long, maybe a couple hundred yards. That is really the bulk of our structure we have here on Plymouth Bay, Massachusetts.
Okay, now Plymouth Bay is just one part of the whole eastern seaboard that stripers frequent, right? How far up and how far down do the stripers actually go on the eastern seaboard?
They go all the way. They come out of the Chesapeake, Delaware, and the Hudson every year in the springtime, and they start the migration north, and they come up the coast. And when they come up the coast, they migrate on an inland pattern pretty close to the shores, and they come into the bays. So from Chesapeake, Delaware, and Hudson, they come out and they come north and they go past our waters here in Massachusetts, and they keep going north right into the Canadian Maritimes. They have stripers in Nova Scotia and north, and then the fish turn back around in the fall and they all come back down and migrate primarily offshore, and they go back down the Chesapeake, Delaware, and Hudson for the winters.
Mm. So without those three water areas, the Hudson, you said, the Delaware, and Chesapeake, we wouldn't be having any stripers, would we?
You wouldn't have stripers. If anything happened to those three bodies of water, and primarily the Chesapeake, striper population would be history, and it'd be a downward spiral to other species as well.
Yeah, and the Chesapeake has had its share of problems.
It has, and that is what's truly amazing, that these fish are so resilient that they can bounce back. We had a population crash at one point many years back, and then the population was managed, and it turned right around and came back. Unbelievable. I mean, by unbelievable, in the spring we can go out in 6 hours, and if you want to try to get 100 striped bass on the fly in 6 hours, it's a very real possibility in the springtime.
Wow, wow. Now, is this the only place that stripers are found on the east coast of the U.S.? Do they exist anywhere else in the world?
Yeah, they have them all throughout the country in different bodies of water. They have stripers on the west coast in a much smaller population. They have them down south in freshwater bodies of water. And striped bass are anadromous fish. They can tolerate freshwater, they can tolerate the salt water, and they can go back and forth once they acclimate. So we actually get striped bass up here in Massachusetts, running up the rivers in the spring, and they're chasing alewives, river herring, and they will go all the way up these rivers right into where it's solid fresh water, chasing the bait, and then they'll turn around and come back down again. So, you know, they do hit other areas around the country where they can gain access from ocean streams, and then also people have taken them and reintroduced them or introduced them to freshwater bodies of water, and they're doing quite well.
Yeah, that, and then you have the hybrids from the striped bass, the wipers and so forth too. But so you've kind of described what the life cycle is already, in that they spawn down in the Chesapeake, Delaware, and Hudson areas, right, and move on up. So do they just migrate up the coast, or do they come back to, like, Plymouth Bay and hang out there like a salmon would when they go back to spawn? Do they return to the same areas every year?
You know, that's a real good question, and I don't have a definite answer for you. I do know that some fish that are tagged do show up in the same areas, you know, year after year. I don't know if that's true for the entire populations of fish, because they're very transient. When they do come out of the Chesapeake and Delaware and Hudson, they come up the coast, and they're in a migratory pattern. So they stop over into these bays, bulking up, and then they move out and they move forward. And literally, fish that you see in a 24-hour period are not the same fish that we'll see in the next 24-hour period. It's changing over that quick, even every 6 hours with our tides. And they keep moving up north. Once the migration is done, all the fish have come out and come north, they stop moving, or they appear to stop moving, and they settle into what we call a summer pattern. And we call them resident fish. They tend to be brighter, shinier colored fish, almost a yellowish color to them, and they look like they've been in the bay for a while. They're not that real bright, shiny color that we see in the spring and the fall when the fish are really moving and they're transient. And they also have what's called a sea lice on them, which is a parasite that lives on their scales and keeps the scales clean of algae and things like that. And fish that come in the bay, we generally say, are fresh fish or bright fish because they have the sea lice on them. After they've been in the bay for about 3 to 5 days, the sea lice drop off. And in the summertime, it's rare that we'll see any sea lice on the fish at all.
Yeah, I remember seeing those sea lice up in Alaska on the salmon when they come in.
Yes, those are fresh fish.
When you caught one of those with sea lice, you knew it was just fresh out of the ocean.
Absolutely, yep.
Yeah. So what size what's an average size of a striper that you catch up there in the Plymouth Bay area?
You know, I wish I could say there was an average size. They range anywhere from 12 inches. Biggest we ever boat was 53 inches. And I would say maybe this year the majority of the fish we were seeing were probably between 24 inches and 34 inches, or at least it seemed to be in that range. Later in the season, after most of the big fish have left, we have a large population of 12-inch stripers that are still here. They were here, you know, a few days ago, and they've since moved on because we had a real cold weather, so that drove them south. But in the springtime, we see quite the mix of fish coming up. In the summertime, we see mostly bigger fish in the summer pattern, and then in the fall again, we see quite the variety of fish, and then the small, what we call micros, towards the end of the migration every year.
I should say,
we see the micros in the bay, but out front, I have a friend, Jessica Heal, who has been getting some very big bass to 47 inches on the front beach the past couple of days. So she's about the only one that I know of that's still fishing our local waters here and pulling up some just huge cow bass.
So it sounds like fish in the upper 40s and 50 is a trophy.
Oh, for sure. Anything in the 40s we consider a trophy fish. You know, and to be honest with you, anything from 36 inches is just a really great fish. And you love to get those, you know, especially on the fly. Oh, my gosh.
Yes, yeah. So, Phil Christensen in Copenhagen, Denmark, wrote in, and he said, I'm from Denmark looking to explore the beaches of Massachusetts. What's the best time of year for sight fishing the shallows? And then he, in parentheses, is January an option? Doesn't sound like it.
Yeah, we're definitely a spring, summer, and early fall fishery here. If you chase the fish further south, you chase them into Rhode Island, you chase them into Connecticut, down to New York, you could extend your season right into December. But up here where we are on the Massachusetts coast, our season starts to hit what we call the spring blitz peak, which is all sight fishing, and it's world class. You have to see it to believe it. and we get in to fish around the 15th of May, and they stay on that topwater spring blitz pattern until about the 10th of June. Now, that's a general guideline. This year, we actually had fish show up the last week, April. We were getting stripers to 37 inches on the fly in April. That's the first we've ever done that in 18 years, because last winter here on the East Coast and elsewhere, we really didn't have a winter. It was just really spring-like all winter long.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the best months for the larger fish are usually May and June then.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. For sight fishing and hitting the flats, it's over the top. And that's when you could have some of those days where you say, today I'm going to try to break 100 fish, and you got a good chance of doing it.
Your arms can take it, huh?
Yeah, you got it.
So, does weather play a role in how the stripers act and whether or not you even go out to fish for them? I mean, obviously big seas is one deterrent, but clouds, you know, wind, well, how does that affect them?
You know, our bay fishes best on a west. So if you get a west wind or a light southerly, or even a light northerly, our bay here at Plymouth Bay, Massachusetts, fishes pretty good on those winds. West is best. I'd take a light southerly second. I'd take a light northerly third. As a general rule, anything with the word east in it is least. So we have a saying that west is best, east is least, north venture not forth, and south blows the bait in the fish's mouth. That's a very general saying, but it holds a lot of truth to it. When we have a light wind, we know it's probably going to be pretty good. If we can couple that light wind with a low pressure system, that's even better. We know that a rising pressure system, as a general rule, will shut the bite or slow it down. We know that a strong easterly, a northeasterly, will shut the bite down or slow it way down. So the weather does play a significant role in the feeding patterns of the fish, and also the fish leave. They just get up and they leave the bay. They'll leave 25 square miles and it's a ghost town. And it's real hard to predict that, but we can go by general guidelines and go by hunches, and we're usually, I'd say, 70 to 80% correct. But every now and then you get burned, you think it's going to be a great day, it's going to be unbelievable, because yesterday was, and today not much has changed. And then you go out there and you're like, where did 2,000 fish go in 12 hours? And they left.
And then they could be back the next morning.
They could be back, or new fish could be back. You just never
know.
They moved
on and others come in. Yeah. Okay.
And they're in someone else's bay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. And you talked about, I'll tell you what, let's take because I think your answer to this will probably be longer. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll dig into these stripers a bit more. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Dave Bitters about stripers on the Massachusetts coast. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. But Dave, I always like to ask my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world, so tell us a bit about what's happening with you, about your business, and anything you're involved with regarding our great sport.
Sure. Well, as you know, I'm a guide out here on the Massachusetts coast. I've been guiding for 18 years, and I've been taking clients from all over the country and abroad out on the bay here in Plymouth Bay, Massachusetts, for striped bass on fly gear. We also do some light tackle work and some bait work, but we do an awful lot of fly work. I tie a fly pattern called the Bayman Universal, B-A-Y-M-E-N. It's an olive pink and white pattern, streamer really, and we also tie it in a clouser type pattern. And that's a pattern I designed years ago to match all the predominant colors of the bait that are in our bay. In addition to guiding, I still am involved in photography, both still photography and videography. And in January this past year, I formed a production company, and I'm producing a television show called The Bayman Life with Captain Dave and Gianna. And The Bayman Life is all about the men and women that make their living and recreation up and down the coast of New England. And a big part of that, as you can imagine, is fly fishing on the bays. So that's what's going on in my life at the moment.
Okay, great, great. Oh, and what's your website address so people know where to find you?
You bet. You can look up my guide service at baymencharters.com, B-A-Y-M-E-N, charters.com.
And this series you're doing, this TV series, where will people see that or how will they find out about that?
You know, we have another Facebook page that we just put up, and best way probably to stay in touch with us is that The Bayman Life with Captain Dave and Gianna, and that's on Facebook. And you can go on there and you could follow us and follow our production, and we can give you all the air times and the networks as things progress.
Okay, great, great. Terrific. Well, we did get a question, kind of a follow-up here on the Internet. Jim in Roswell, Georgia, he wrote in and he says, we have stripers that run on the coast of Georgia during the winter and spawn. They disappear during the winter months. Do you think they come down from the Chesapeake Bay also?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, there's...
Are they confused or what?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if they're confused, but I think they just have a more broader range than we probably know about or that we speculate about. I remember years ago up here in the North River on the Massachusetts coast, there was a gentleman that caught a 50-pound striped bass on a dead eel, and that was in December. So that fish was either what we call a resident fish or a holdover fish, or it was a very late migrant fish that happened to stay because the waters were warm, there's plenty to eat, and for whatever reason, he wasn't getting the signal to start moving south. So we do have some holdover fish, and one year we said we're going to try to catch a striped bass every month of the year up here in Massachusetts waters for the whole year. We did it, and it wasn't easy. And it was more work than it was fun, and I wouldn't want to try to do it again, to be honest with you. But some of the fish that we were getting were being caught with plenty of snow on the ground. We're getting them in these little narrow creeks on the bottom in, you know, a few feet of water, usually when the tide went out, and little guzzles that still hold water. They held some ratty stripers. And when you caught those fish, they looked like holdovers. They were pretty beat up.
Like the night after, huh? I mean, the
That's
morning
right.
after
even,
kind of thing.
Even worse, let me tell you.
Hungover.
They've been running to the mill.
It's not easy living up here anymore, no.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I kind of wonder, did they make a, they should have made a right, left turn, and they made a right turn out of Chesapeake and got down to Georgia, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, thanks for sharing that. You know, you keep mentioning the tides, and sounds like that's a big thing for the fishery that you work in.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit more about that. Is that, do you always go out and fish when the tide's in, or do you like to fish when it's moving in or out, or what's the best?
You know, I tell people that we can find striped bass on any tide, any time that the fish are here from May until October. So we can always find fish. In our bay out here, our 25 square miles, I got about 55, 60 spots that are what I mentioned we call microstructure, and we can hit those spots. So remember, the tide is changing from dead low to maybe 12 feet of water in 6 hours, and our charters run about 6 hours. So no matter when you go out, you're going to be fishing moving water, and the waters are going to be extremely different from when we started to when we finish your trip. So we literally watch our watch. We watch the tides, and we know what time they're going to peak out. We know how high they're going to be. We know if they're going to be a plus tide, meaning they're going to be above the mean average high water mark, or if they're going to be a negative tide, which is the mean low water mark. And we can adjust our schedule, our fishing schedule that morning, depending on the tide, and also depending on the wind and the time of year, and the pattern that the fish appear to be in. So the tides are huge. We live by the tides. And we fish by the tides, but we can always find fish on the bay on any given tide. You just have to fish it differently.
So is there a time of day that's better to find the stripers?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Oh.
The absolute best time to fish sight fishing topwater striped bass on our bay is a half hour before sunrise to 2 hours after. That is prime time. Now, that's a general rule. I've come in at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and the fish are still breaking water like it was, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning. So the thing that keeps it interesting is the tides are always moving, and the bass move with the tides. And bass change the rules all the time. You think you got it figured out. You know they shouldn't be here on a northeast wind, on a dropping tide, on a rising pressure system, and the water temp's, you know, too cold. But they could change that, and they could be there that day. And so we go by the general rules, but every now and then they throw us a curve, and you kind of scratch your head and say, well, they've never done that before.
Now, so they're at the surface more during that time, and then they tend to go deeper during the day? Is that what you're...
Yeah, generally speaking. They go deeper. It gets brighter out. They tend to go deeper. If you have a foggy day, we have a lot of fog here on the coast in the spring. I mean, pea soup, you can't see more than 100 feet in front of you, maybe. That's tough going, but it keeps the fish up. So when you have fog, you have heavy overcast, as a general rule, it keeps the fish on top water, so sight fishing is very possible. As you get the high pressure system coming in or brighter days, real sunny days, it tends to shut off the topwater bite. The fish are still here, but they just change their patterns in the way that they feed. Striped bass can't dilate their pupils. So they don't blink and they don't have a dilating pupil. So they're very sensitive to light. And also, because they have a big, huge pupil, you know, they're primarily a nighttime feeding fish. We don't fish the night because, you know, we got to sleep at some point, and we got to prep for the next morning's charter. So we do the morning trips from pre-dawn until about 11 a.m. or noon.
Oh, I see. Okay. Take advantage of that time. Now, is there, you know, of course, I'm out in the Rocky Mountains, and a lot of trout work similarly in that in the lakes and so forth. They will come to the shore in the evening at twilight, mainly because they're no longer, you know, fearful of predators and so forth.
Yes.
It may be a different reason, but do stripers have any top or above water predators that they would fear?
Yeah, absolutely. We have what we call spooky fish or skittish fish, and those are fish that have generally been pushed pretty hard and been chased, you know, schools of fish that have been chased by anglers from Chesapeake on up, and they can get boat shy. So in a sense, that's a predator or something mm-hmm. that spooks them. Other predators are large striped bass. They'll eat small striped bass. So the big dogs generally run by themselves, and the smaller ones run in their size or year class. That's why we call them year class fish. Also, we have osprey that come back to our bays every spring, and they feed pretty heavily on stripers. We have seals in the bay in the spring and the fall, and they feed very heavily on stripers, as well as late fall if there's any fish still here. We have bluefish that come in the bay. There's bluefin tuna offshore. So all those species will eat striped bass if they can catch them.
Okay. So they're not top of the food chain by any means.
No, that's for sure.
Good. What about water temperature? You mentioned earlier sometimes, you know, when the winter comes in, then the fish will move out.
Yeah.
Does that play a role during the season?
Yeah, it sure does. It's huge. I remember a couple of years back, I was guiding one of my regular clients, Rich Comstock from New York, and he comes up and fishes me probably six times a year, and he's a dyed-in-the-wool fly rodder, excellent fly rodder, and he came up with me and booked 2 days in the spring, and the first day we went out, the water temp was 52 degrees, and we fished for 6 hours, and we never saw a bass or caught a fish, all right? So the very next day, we went back out. The water temp rose 2 degrees over the night to 54 degrees. And the bay lit and was absolutely on fire with stripers. I don't remember how many we caught, but it was probably over 70. And that was because of the water temps that had warmed up a couple degrees. The bait moved, and the stripers moved with the bait, and they came into the bay.
So that's usually what's triggering it is it's the bait. Right? What's happening with the bait?
Absolutely. You find the bait, you find the fish, although there are times, fall was one of the times, where the bait was so thick and there was so much of it, it was unmolested. because there was so much other bait miles away that the bass were hanging on the other bait.
Okay. Yeah. Just a correction. We had, when I was talking about the stripers down in Georgia, I misread his message. He said they disappear in the warmer months. I said winter months. So.
Oh, okay.
That's
normal. That's normal. We have our fish up here that go into the summer pattern, and all the topwater fish that we're seeing, all the fish around the bay disappear, you know, from sight, and they tend to go into the summer pattern, and that's when you find the bigger fish lurking around structure, feeding on other baits, and, you know, they're resident fish that have decided to stay here, and the other fish that we have been seeing are gone. July is one of our slowest months of the year for striped bass inside the bay for sight fishing. And the reason being because there are no fish in the bay on topwater that time of year. The fish that are here are harder to find, and they're generally deeper down in deeper, colder waters, and they're feeding on larger baits. And you really got to put your time in, and you got to cover a lot of territory, a lot of miles of water to find those fish.
Let's talk about some of the equipment you need. Eddie in Bridgewater, Mass. wrote in, and he says, "Hi, Dave. I just moved from Scotland to the U.S., just south of Boston. I'm a river fisherman, but looking forward to having to go to the salt. Would my 10'8" weight be good for stripers?"
Yeah, it's a little long, to be honest with you, but if you're fishing from shore, it's probably okay. We generally fish 8-weight, 9-weight, and 10-weight fly rods. Sometimes we'll use what we call a crossover fly rod or a schoolie rod, and we'll go to a 7-weight. And that's a nice rod if you're in small fish and you're fishing small areas and you're fishing maybe estuaries where you could get other species of fish mixed in. So getting back to his question, 10'8", yeah, I think you'd be fine. I caught 2 40-inch fish on an 8-weight once. It was a 9-foot, and I wish I had my 10-weight with me because I couldn't leverage them off the bottom. It took a long time. So, you know, just keep that in mind, and if you know you're going to be into big fish, you'll probably want to go up to a 10-weight.
And what did you say the preferred length is, 9?
Yeah, 9-foot, 10-weight, 9-foot, 9-weight is probably the most popular rod here on the Mass Coast.
Okay. And you said this, we had Greg write in on the Internet from Gainesville, Georgia. He said, "What's the smallest rod that you can get away with up there?" So that would be the 7-weight, but you're asking for trouble if you hook into a 40-inch fish.
I talked to an angler today that was fishing on Brown's Bank, and he had his 5-weight with him because he thought he was going to just get all little rinky-dink fish. He caught an 18-pound striped bass on his 5-weight. He had to throw the anchor on the boat, empty his pockets, jump out of the boat, and he had to follow the fish across the flats on foot and let that fish. And it was 18 pounds on a 5-weight.
So there you go, Greg. If if you're
That's
willing
impressive.
To put in,
you can do it. You can do it.
Yeah, those fish are strong, too. You know, the fish from the salt are just way stronger than the fish in the fresh water, I've found.
Oh, they can be crazy, they can be heavy, and they can be hard to turn, you know. Stories abound in our area from anglers that hooked into fish they couldn't turn and couldn't slow down. And, you know, we have some brutes in our bay and up and around the coast. And can I tell you one story about the biggest fish I ever saw?
Sure.
About 3 years ago, of course, I have no witnesses, didn't have a camera. I was by myself. I was in the boat. I don't remember why I was out by myself. I was probably just doing some scouting, trying to find some fish. And it was in, I want to say late June, and could have been July. I'd have to look the date up on my log. But I went out, and I was scouting around trying to find fish, and I had some pogey with me. And I wasn't fly fishing at that time when I was out there that day. And I had the pogies, and I was just putting pogies over, trying to attract fish to see if I get some big fish to come up and say, okay, we know there's big fish here. We can come back and target them with any type of gear at all, including the fly. And I fished this one spot just north of Clark's Island on our bay. Clark's Island is an island about, maybe 3/4 of a mile long by a little less than 1/2 mile wide, probably a little smaller than that. And it was named after the mate on the Mayflower. And it's where the shallop washed up on shore, incidentally, when the pilgrims were coming into Plymouth Bay to scout around themselves. And they got into a storm. The shallop washed up. They broke their mast. They didn't know they were on an island until the next morning. They washed up there in the dark. But that's just a little history about that island. North of that island, I was fishing some live pogie, setting some drifts. I was drifting off a flat over a very deep channel and then up onto another flat. And when I came off the flat on one of the drifts and went over the deep channel, I had a monster bass come up and smack my pogie 7 times, knocking it clear out of the water, killed the pogie. The last time he hit the pogie, he was maybe 10 feet from the boat. He was right beside me. I could almost reach out and touch him. This fish is the biggest striped bass I've ever seen. I've seen Charlie Cinto's state record striped bass of 73 pounds. I've seen the mount. I've seen it. I've taken pictures of it. This fish dwarfed that fish. It had to be a 90-pound-plus striped bass. Mm. Had to be. It was the biggest prehistoric-looking fish I've ever seen in the bay. And my first thought was, if I hook this fish, I'm going to be famous. My second thought was, if I hook this fish, I will never land it on the gear that I have on board. And yeah. I drifted that spot, I want to say, 15 more times, exactly the same. I never saw another fish, and I never saw that bass again.
Mm. Well, and you see a lot of fish in the water, so you should be a good judge of size and weight.
I get a pretty good idea.
Yeah,
I'm pretty comfortable. And when I take my charters, you know, when they hook into a fish or if we're using our regular gear, I can guess how big that fish is by watching the bend in the rod and the way the fish is fighting. You know,
yeah.
You tell that's a 34 to 36 inch fish, I'm willing to bet. And usually it's pretty close, right in that range.
Yeah, I
so
know
a lot
of guides are good like that. I was fishing for a pike up in northern Manitoba, and the guide we had up there, you know, when you hooked into a good fish, you know, a 40, 42 inch pike or something, he knew right away. He would tell by the rod as well. He says, oh,
right.
That's a big fish. And,
right.
and then there it just kind of went slow and steady, you know. It didn't tug,
yeah.
It didn't, you know, it's just like the slow, steady movement. And the smaller ones jump around, fly out of the water, do all this other stuff.
Oh,
those
the wicked
kind of sound.
Yeah, it's really, you know, people sometimes say, oh, come on. I says, well, you know, if you catch 3,000 fish a season, you got a pretty good idea of what size fish is on the end of your line, you know?
Yeah,
when you see
yeah,
that many
definitely.
Fish coming over the side of the boat.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about equipment and flies and how to find these stripers. So be right back. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish, big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snooker tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Dave Bitters about stripers on the Massachusetts coast. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at Ask About Fly Fishing and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Let's see here. Just checking. We've got a question come in on fly patterns. We're going to get to that in just a second, so I'll hold that one off. Dave, what kind of lines do you have to use when you're out for the stripers, or do you have to switch it up for different reasons?
Yeah, we switch it up quite a bit. We use floating, intermediate, as well as sinking lines. Our floating line, you know, we use Airflows, we use Rios. We love the Rio lines. We've used some of the Wonder lines from Orvis. You know, they're all good. The big thing is just to keep your lines clean, keep them in good condition, and know how to use them and how to apply them to your different circumstances. Floating line we use primarily when we're fishing poppers, topwater poppers, and there is nothing like fishing a topwater popper in skinny water and watching the fish come up and slam it. I mean, that's the ultimate for me. So a floating line is really an application line in that case. Another way we use a floating line is when we're targeting striped bass with crab patterns. The stripers will come in here in mid to late May. They'll start grubbing the shallows for small green crabs. And we'll fish a crab pattern on a floating line, let the crab pattern actually sink down on the sand and let it sit. And when we see a tailing fish look that way, we'll twitch the crab pattern and let the striper come over, bend down, suck it in. Eagle watch the whole thing, the gills flare. It's quite a thrill when all that comes together. The next line we use is an intermediate line. And again, Rio makes a great one. We like intermediate lines with a sink rate of 2 to 3 inches a second. And those lines we can use for topwater fish if we have to get subsurface, say with a clouser pattern, or even a streamer pattern that is slightly weighted. So we'll fish those in all depth of water if the fish are, say, within 8 feet of the surface or closer. And then the third line that we use is a sinking line. We use a salmon line, believe it or not. Jim Teeny makes a salmon line, 300-grain sinking line. I think it's a 24-foot shooting head on it, and then a running line that's floating on the back end. And, man, you can cast that thing on an 8-weight, 9-weight, or 10-weight all day, and it's like casting an intermediate line. It's not like casting a sinking line. And it sinks around 6 inches, maybe up to 8 inches a second, and we can put, you know, any type of pattern on the end of that to get it down to the fish in the deeper waters. And we'll use a cast and count method where we cast out, then we'll snake line on the water. We'll put a lot of big snakes of line and just let that line drift back with the current and sink down. We'll count out the seconds that we want it to get down to. If we know it sinks, you know, 6 inches a second, we just count out the seconds. We know exactly how deep that pattern is. So those are our three primary lines, floating, intermediate, and sinking.
So when you said you're using the counting method, and I assume you're keeping track of that to try to find out where they are in the water column.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, experimentation.
You try to find out the depth that the fish are at, because stripers are like other fish. They will hold in certain depth for different reasons, usually where the bait is, or maybe there's a thermal climb there that they really like and they're comfortable in that. And you got to find that some days. I remember one day we were on the bay, and again, there was no topwater action, and we were searching the bay for fish. We finally found some fish, and they were holding at about 14 feet of water. And we had to do an awful long count because we had a little bit of wind, and we had quite a bit of current. So we really had our count to try to get that fly down. But every single fish we got was, you know, down at that 14-foot level. If you were above it, you weren't going to catch them.
So do you ever use fish finders to find the fish?
You know, we have them on board, and I'm old school. That's one thing people realize right away when they book me to be their guide. I don't use GPS. I have a compass on board, and I know my way around the bay by compass, and I use a sonar primarily for checking water depth, just to reconfirm what I'm already thinking in my mind. It's very helpful on a very heavy, dense fog day, compass and sonar. But we also use the sonar on occasion when we're having trouble finding fish, or if we're into that summer pattern where the fish are down deep and you're not going to see them on the surface, then the sonar is used occasionally as a tool. But I fished this bay for 18 years and I know it pretty well, so I generally go by my hunches on where the fish are going to be based upon my logs that I've kept for years and years, and they're usually pretty accurate. And we'll start with our top 10 spots based on the wind, the tide, the time of year. And if we don't find them in those 10 spots, we'll go to our next 10 spots. If they're not there, we go to our next 10 spots. And, you know, it's rare you'll get through 10 spots and not find your fish. You'll find them usually pretty quick or towards the tail end of, you know, your 7th, 8th, 9th spot.
How deep can you effectively fish for them on a fly?
Our bay averages 15 feet in depth. Our deepest spot is 80 feet, and our shallows are the flats. We're fishing 6 inches to a couple of feet. So we can effectively fish for striped bass in our bay easily to, I'd say, about the 8-foot level, no problem. When you get into those fish that are going to be at 12, 14 feet down, everything slows way down because you have to really apply your cast and count, and you have to take the time to get the fly down there. When the fish are on topwater and you're looking at 20 acres of fish breaking in front of you, you can't get the fly out there fast enough and rip it back quick enough to get into those fish. So, you know, that's the big thrill for me, but when you got to mix it up and slow it down, you really have to adjust your techniques and fish that deep of water. So A majority of our fish, the keepers, are caught in, I would say, 3 feet to 7 feet of water, and we'll fish up to maybe 14 feet of water if we have to.
Wow. Let's talk about what the stripers eat. You have mentioned certain food sources so far tonight, but can you kind of run down their major food sources?
You bet. Striped bass will eat anything they could fit into their mouth at one time or another.
Okay,
that's the general rule. Now, that said, they will go on a selective feed, and they will feed only on one size or one type of bait exclusively, even if you are swimming a live bait in front of them that isn't what they want at that particular time. I've seen bluefish do the same thing on our bay, and it will try the patience of the best guides. You know, the number one bait, I would say, in our bay in the springtime, when the bass are coming in, is herring. They're following the herring that is coming in from the sea and running up all the coastal rivers and streams to spawn, and they will come in and follow them right up. Blueback herring, river herring. We also have shad that come in the bay, and they'll chase and eat the shad. Once those fish are up the rivers, the bass sometimes will drop back down, and they'll start feeding on other baits that are available to them, including lobsters, green crabs, mama chogs or killifish, mackerel, pollock. When the water temperatures start to warm up, and we have sand eels, they'll feed on a sand eel. They will feed on a butterfish. They'll feed on a silverside that comes in our bay. And then they will feed on what we call peanut bunker or bunker. And those are basically menhaden of various sizes. And they go from, pretty big to probably 12, 14 inches, all the way down to what we call micros, and they can't be more than an inch long. And when they get on the micros, it is real difficult to catch fish, even though you're seeing thousands of fish in front of you. One other bait that the bass do feed on 3 to 4 times a year, if the conditions are right, is a clam worm and a cinder worm. And they will feed on these little tiny worms, an inch, 2 inches long, maybe 3 inches long for big ones, like the most finicky trout in fresh water. And they will try your patience, and they will sip these worms on the surface, just like trout will. And they won't touch anything else.
Never thought they'd be that picky. Boy.
Oh, it's crazy, and it drives you nuts. One other thing, they'll eat flounder. They love to eat flounders.
And those are bottom-feeding fish. So
bottom, you bet.
Work the bottom.
Huh? Wow. Yeah.
So what, you've mentioned a lot of food sources there, but what are some of the flies you use to imitate those food sources?
You know, our number one fly that we use on my charters is a pattern I designed called the Bayman Universal. I designed it probably 15 years ago or more, and it's basically a streamer pattern made out of almost all bucktail. And it has a little bit of pink in the middle. It's got bleached white bucktail on the bottom for the belly. And it's got olive bucktail on the top for the back dressing. And then over the olive bucktail, we put peacock curl, which gives it a little more breathing action. The last thing we do is put a little red, bright red bucktail right under the neck or chin on the bottom of the fly to simulate gills. And then we put on 3D soft prism eyes, silver with a black pupil. And I wrap all that with Danville flat wax nylon. And we tie it primarily on an Eagle Claw 254 SS hook. But we will use any hook that we have that will do the job depending on the size of the fish. So as long as it's a saltwater hook, and we'll crimp the barbs on those too, by the way, more often than not. If you're going for a really big fish, you're planning on keeping them, we won't crimp those barbs down. But if we're doing catch and release, which is almost always the case with the fly guys, then we'll crimp those barbs and, you know, it's easy on, easy off. So that's our primary pattern, the Bayman Universal, Captain Dave's Bayman Universal. Second pattern that I absolutely love for this bay is a half and half in yellow and in white. Those two colors on the same pattern. And the half and half is half clouser, half deceiver. And it has so much action to it, and we can fish that, tick it along the bottom, and it's just an absolute killer pattern. Third pattern that we use on the bay is a traditional pattern, chartreuse and white clouser, or olive and white clouser. And those patterns will pretty much do it all most of the time on the bay. You just have to adjust the size, length of the pattern, and you have to adjust the transparency or thickness of the materials on the fly. The striped bass look at bait this way: size first, shape second, color third. So when they're on a feeding frenzy or a feeding pattern, the first thing they're looking for is something that fits the size that the whole school of fish is imprinted on. So once they got the size, that's what they're going to go after. Shape is the second one. So if you can match your fly pattern to the shape of the bait they're feeding on and the size, you're going to increase your odds. And the third is the color. As a general rule, those colors I mentioned are the very best. The only exception is when the peanut bunker is in the bay and it's very bright and shiny, or perhaps the silver sides that are in the bay, which are very bright pearl with a silver stripe down the side. If you can tie a pattern that is more white to match those patterns, you're going to do better on your hookups.
And we did do a show on those menhaden, because that's a whole topic in and of itself.
You can become obsessed with it, too. And when the fish goes selective, that's when you start to get obsessive on how perfect your flies have to look, and it can drive you crazy.
Yeah, we did. If people want to go on an archive, we did an interview with Bo Beasley on how many menhaden do we really need and why fly anglers care, and it's kind of like what's going on with that. And, you know, you think bait fish aren't, well, they're just bait fish. Well, that's what this, many of these bait fish, you know, we wouldn't have trophy fish and sport fish if we didn't have the bait fish. So that's an interesting show to go listen to find out what's really going on with one of our primary East Coast bait fish. So, good. So we got the Bayman Universal, the half and half, and the Clouser is the three. What different sizes, you know, what's the range of sizes that you tie in?
Generally, the Bayman Universal is about 2 inches in length. If we keep the peacock long on the back and we use some long white bucktail, we might go up to maybe a 3-inch pattern. But that's usually the maximum on that particular pattern. On the half and half, depending on the yellow saddle hackle that you tie in that comes off the back, you could be having something up to 6 inches long. And on the clouser, they're generally short and small in the chartreuse and white and the olive and white. You could tie them down to 1 inch, 2 inch, maybe 2.5 inches. It's rare that you're going to go larger than that, because you might as well go up to the half and half.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. All right, let's take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about finding them, and presentation and strategy. So hold on, folks, and we'll be right back. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge directly at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dave Bitters about stripers on the Massachusetts coast. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Let's see here. Now, we did get a question in on the Internet, Dave, from Brian in Woodstock, Georgia. He said, what is the most consistent productive fly pattern during the fall run? And does that fly pattern or the size color of it differ during the spring?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. In the fall, when the stripers are feeding primarily on bunker in the bay and also juvie herring that are coming back down out of the rivers, if they go onto the bunker, we have to fish a bright colored pattern that is primarily a bleached white bucktail or a white half and half or a white clouser. That is going to be your best pattern for sure. And in a 3-inch or a 2-inch, depending on the size of the peanut bunker in the bay. As the bunker gets bigger, or if we have a mixed, diversified bunch of bait in the bay, we can go right back to the Bayman Universal and the half and half in the yellow and the white. In the springtime, when the fish are migrating, they tend not to be as selective. They tend to be bulking up on whatever is in front of them. And that's a general rule. Sometimes they break it. But whatever is in front of them, they're going to hit. What matters more in the springtime is the speed of your retrieve and how you retrieve it. And you can get the bass to hit a wide variety of patterns by mixing up your retrieve. But in the fall, when they're going down, coming through and working their way south, if the peanut bunker in the bay, you got to match the hatch.
Okay, good. Let's talk about finding stripers. And we, you know, obviously you're doing, I think, probably most of your work from a boat. But we've got a lot of fly fishers out there that are going to try to get stripers from the shore as well. So how did you said you had favorite spots from the boat, but let's say you don't have any favorite spots. You're new to this. How do you find the fish, whether it be from a boat or from the shore?
You know, your number one go-to for me, now I'm old school, okay, you got to remember that. I'm going to go get a paper nautical chart of the bay, and I'm going to study that chart, and I'm going to learn every cut on the bay, every little piece of structure. If I'm fishing shoreline, I'm going to want to know where the flats are and where they drain. I'm going to want to know where the cuts are in the banks. I'm going to want to know the depth of the drop-off. And those drop-offs, I want to be there at high tide or, say, the last hour of incoming through the first or maybe first 2 hours of dropping. And I'm going to study that chart. You can also, with all the apps that are available today, you could log on, pull up an app, and look at something probably in real time or at least look at a picture and really zoom in on an area that you're going to be fishing and see if it looks fishy. And if you're experienced, you know what to look for. You're looking for structure. You're looking for cuts. You're looking for areas that are going to drain and take bait with them. From a boat, it's the same way. We do the same things. I start with a nautical chart, and I study the chart heavily. And it's a real good place to get your bases and go from there. Another thing you want to look for, obviously, is birds and how they're responding on the bay. If you really study birds, I really study birds. I loved ornithology, and I studied it in college. So I like to study birds. I like to study them all the way down to the minute details, the sounds they make, how they're communicating to other birds, the way they're flying, the way they're diving, the way they are moving in flocks, and the way they're moving individually. And if you study birds, which is really a hobby of mine, you will learn what they are telling you, and you can glean a lot of information from different types of birds. The lesser terns, the common terns, the roseate terns, the ring-billed gulls, the herring gulls, and the great black-back gulls, and also the laughing gulls. We pay attention to all those birds, and also, to a lesser degree, cormorants, egrets, great white egrets, snowy egrets, common night herons, yellow crown night herons, black crown night herons, and also great blue herons, and osprey. Osprey is the other bird that we pay attention to. So nautical charts, and then study the birds, and then talk to other anglers. Talk to people in bait shops. You know, most guys are going to give you the straight up on fish. There's really not a whole lot of secrets because fish move, tides are always moving, and timing is everything. So take all that knowledge and apply it, and then you got to go out there and you got to scout on your own. And you got to study an area and you got to learn it. And the reason there's guides in the business is because a lot of people visiting an area don't have that kind of time. So they hire a guide like myself who's been there for 20, 30 years and can put you right on the fish, you know, in a matter of minutes, knowing where to be at what time.
Right. Now, we had a question about what kind of structure that the stripers prefer, and this is primarily, I guess, talking from a from the coast, you know, not from a boat. But they like rocky points, channels, or beaches as their preference?
The number one preference of a striped bass is anything that creates a rip. And a rip is any body of water that is being interrupted and creating turbulence. They love those areas, and they love to be on the down tide side of it, or the down side of the rip coming towards them, the water hitting it coming towards them. It tends to discombobulate bait that might be moving through there, and they really like to move back and forth. So that's more important than saying a rocky point or a dip in a sandbar or a cut. If it's creating a rip, you're going to find bass there if you're there at the right tide.
Okay.
That said, down south in Maryland, they call striped bass rockfish because stripers do love rocks. Reason being, there's a lot of structure. It's a great place to hide, but it's also a great place for bait to hide. And the bass know that, and they like to move in and out of the rocks. Another thing that bass really love is eelgrass beds, thick eelgrass beds that waves in the water. And if you have eelgrass and then a patch of sand and then more eelgrass and a patch of sand, that is absolutely ideal cover, and you're creating what we call transition areas, and the bass love to move in and out of those transition areas looking for bait or just mulling about and relaxing.
Yeah, we just talked to, the last interview I did was with Aaron Adams, and I don't know if you know Aaron, but he was talking about all these ecosystems that on the East Coast, and he was talking about eelgrass and the transition zones and how the fish love these transition zones, and so that's another interview people might want to listen to about different ecosystems that exist that the fish love. But, yeah, so that's a very important tip that you just gave, because that creates a lot of possibilities. And from what I heard from you, let's say we had a rock out there, then on an incoming tide we'd be on the one side of the rock, and on an outgoing tide we'd be on the other side of the rock looking for fish. Did I hear you correctly?
Exactly,
yeah.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
And it can be a rock, it can be a dip, it can be a bump in the water, it can be anything. Where water is funneled through a gauntlet, anywhere at all, but you want to be on the downward side of it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what about sight casting versus blind casting? What percentage do you do of each, would you say?
You know, I would say I do 70% sight casting because it's available to us. That is the big thrill for me. If you can see fish that are breaking or finning or tailing or chasing bait, and you can target them, and if you can see specific fish, and they're big fish, and you can target those fish and hook into that bass, there is nothing that beats fly fishing or striped bass in that realm. I mean, that is the best of the best. If they're not on top water, and they're on structure, and they're holding down below, then you have no choice than to fish the structure blindly, hoping that the fish are on that structure, and you work the structure very methodically, just like the hands on a clock. And generally, when you're facing an area, you fish it from 9 to 10 to 11 to 12 to 1 to 2 to 3. So you cover that entire arc before you move. Then you move down the coast or you move over on the flat, and then you fish that 9 to 3 again. And we don't spend a lot of time on the spots hoping the fish are going to appear. You know, if the fish are on top, well, let me put it this way. If the fish are not on top, they're down below. And if they're not down below, they're somewhere else, and you got to move. You have to keep moving. And one thing people say to me on my chart is say, boy, you move around quite a bit. Well, we average 15 fish per trip. Some days we're getting 50, 60, 70, 100 fish per trip, and it's because we're moving and we're not staying in the same spot. We're doing what the bass do, and we move with the tides.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you go out in the early morning, what's your strategy from a boat? Are you're going to go to these favorite spots, and are you immediately looking for topwater fish, finning fish, and so forth?
Yeah, depending on the time of year, depending on the tides, and depending on what the weather conditions are, we will make our top 10 list accordingly, and we will know the tides, you know, exactly when we go out. And we'll take that top 10 and we'll start hitting our spots on the bay. If the first thing we look for, and I tell every charter this before we leave the dock, our first goal is to target topwater fish. If we can't find topwater fish, then we're going to target structure fish. So we do go out and we start looking for topwater fish, chasing bait, busting bait on the surface, maybe corralling the bait. Maybe they're tailing. If they're feeding on crabs in the shallows, we'll look for tails sticking up out of the water, almost like redfish. Or we will be targeting bass that could be down deep feeding on the structure, eating crabs in the springtime, maybe chasing some other larger baits in the summertime, and in the fall they could be chasing a variety of baits down deep or on top. So it really depends. The time of year and what the fish are doing, you have to adapt, and you have to adapt quickly. If they're on top, we're going all floating in intermediate lines. If we're not finding them on top, floating and intermediate is put away, and we break out the sinking line, and we stick with the sinking to fish the structure.
Okay. And then what's your approach and your presentation to the fish, and, you know, combined with your retrieve? Is there anything specific you do? Or?
Yeah, it's very specific. And this is where a lot of guys miss the boat, and they have all the other things together, but they miss these key things. Fishing is all about, when you're guiding, fishing is all about percentage points, and everything you do right is worth a couple of percentage points. And if you do everything right on your checklist, all those percentage points add up to 100% success. If you don't follow the formula on some of those points and you don't do it correctly, you're going to lose points, and that means you're going to lose fish for your clients. So I'm very meticulous most days when we go out. The number one thing you have to do is set your drifts for your fish upwind and let the wind carry you down over the fish. When you have wind and tide competing against each other, the wind almost always wins, so you go with the wind. On those days when there isn't any wind, the tide will dictate your drift, and you set the tide of the fish, and you drift down over them. Okay, that is really, really key. Another thing that I see a lot of guys doing is they don't shut their engines off. For whatever reason, their engine is running the whole time. If you drift over fish or try to come up on spooky fish and you got an engine running, you're going to spook all those fish out of there or catch very few fish or much fewer fish than you would have if you shut your engine off. So shut your engine off, set your drift upwind, or if there's no wind, set it up tight and drift over the fish. And don't start your engine until you've drifted way past where the fish are. And the other thing, and this is key, don't turn your boat around after your drift and go back upwind or back up tide, drive over or through the fish, and reset your drift and come back across them, because you're going to spook those fish. You have to finish out your drift, get way beyond the fish, and then make a huge arc to go around those fish and get way upwind or stream and come back down over them again. I can't stress that enough, and I see guys every day totally ignoring that, and they're not catching the quantities or the quality fish that they could be catching if they just put the extra time in and follow those basic rules.
Do you have any need for stripping baskets or other line handling methods on the boat?
Yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with stripping baskets. And if you want to use one, that's fine with me. I've gone with them, and now I've gone without them. I'm without them right now, and I'm very happy. What I do is I'll take a wet towel, and I'll cover over any cleat that's on the boat so your line can't tangle on it. I'll make sure dock lines and everything else is all cleaned off the deck. Our decks are set up on our Carolina skiffs to be very clean and to be accommodating for a fly angler up on the front deck. So it's pretty rare that your line is catching on anything other than maybe your own feet. So I hate stripping baskets. The time I really love them is when I'm on the shore and you got wind and tide washing all around your feet and the fish suddenly break 50 yards to your right. Well, you're not going to pick up all your line and run to the right 50 yards. You got to have it in a stripping basket, and then you got to run up the beach. So you need one for sure from shore.
Okay, good to know. Okay, Jim in White Plains, New York wrote in, and he says, that stripers are feeding on adult menhaden in a cove or small harbor. What fly sizes, leaders, lines, techniques do you use to get them? I think we talked about the flies. You were in the light and white category, right?
Yeah, he's talking about mature menhaden, though. That's a whole different ballgame. When you're fishing with mature menhaden, you want a big fly. You can use a very big fly that's going to simulate a menhaden, and it can be, you know, a foot-long fly if you want to throw something that big. And if they'll take a smaller fly, great, but generally if they want those big, huge baits, you're going to have a big, huge fly that has a big, huge profile in olive and white, because your pogies are going to be olive and white, more shiny, but with olive backs to them, and a big eye. Don't neglect the big eye on a pogie pattern. But keep in mind, too, you're going to have to be throwing that thing on a 10-weight, maybe a 9-weight, and you're going to have a short, stout leader, because you're not going to turn over that big fly with a 9-foot, 8-foot, 7-foot leader, probably a 3- or 4-foot leader, and you'll turn that fly over really quickly and easily. And targeting those fish, again, if you're seeing them, and you could target them with that fly, all the better. And a sinking line is probably going to be your better bet, maybe an intermediate, but I would probably go with a sinking, a 300-grain teeny with a 24-foot shooting head or so, and that would get the job done for you.
Okay, great. Now, in your area, in the Plymouth Bay area, do you need to have a boat there, or can you fish from the shore or piers or jetties?
Yeah, you can fish from shore. There's a lot of areas from shore, but you have to be able to gain the access, and you have to be able to have a good map, chart of the bay, know where to go, and talk to other anglers and shops, because access is always a problem, and it is limited. But that said, there's still an awful lot of shoreline you can fish in Plymouth waters, encompassing Duxbury Bay, Kingston Bay, and Plymouth Bay, that 25-square-mile area. Mm-hmm. So I actually guided shoreline for 3 years before I became a U.S. Coast Guard licensed captain. So I was taking people on shoreline, all the time. I had to get some four-wheel drive permits to get out on the beaches, but you can do it, yes.
Okay. Scott in Virginia wrote in, and he says, I grew up in the Northeast and have been striper fishing from shore for years, but have yet to figure out which tide, incoming or outgoing, is better and which bait seems to work the best. Could you enlighten me?
Sure. If I could pick any tide, my favorite tide in the whole wide world would be a dead low incoming through high tide. That's my favorite tide. The reason being, you see all the structure on the bay at low tide when there's no water, and you see it getting covered. You see the structure causing the water flows that are going to attract striped bass, and you know, if you got a good memory or make notes, when there's 12 feet of water covering that, you can remember what's underneath it, what the structure is, and why it might be holding bass down below there. That said, half tide incoming is also very nice because that's generally when the bulk of the fish are moving in on the tide. Also, a high tide, the last hour of high tide is very nice because you're getting a flood tide and the fish are pushing up close to shore. And if the bait is running to shore or running up little streams and rivers, the high tides are the time you want to fish those areas. But then the dropping tide is also good because you got moving water again. The worst tide to fish is a slack tide. A slack tide is when the tide is between high and turning around to start going back out again, or low and turning around to start coming in again. Those tides, generally speaking, run about 30 to 45 minutes, and there's nothing going on or very little going on. And again, general rule, I've caught fish at low tide and on slack tide, and I've gotten big fish. But the general rule is the fish like the moving water, so then they're more active. The best pattern, I fish my Bayman Universal. I mean, I have tested that and tweaked it and done everything you can do to it. I'd fish that as my go-to pattern to start on the bays any time of year for sure.
I think you've just answered a couple other questions that folks wrote into about fishing from the beach and finding structure and working the tides.
Can I tell you one thing about fishing from the shore?
Sure.
You know, a lot of people will say, oh, there's a good shore spot. It's high tide. They'll walk out to the edge of the marsh. They'll stand there, and they'll start casting, throwing their fly as far out as they can get it. I tell people, if you can make a 70-foot or better cast consistently every cast and do it in 3 false casts, you're going to do pretty good with me. If you can't throw 70 feet line, you can only throw 60 or 40, you're going to have a tough time. But the key thing from shoreline is don't walk out to the shore and start throwing your line as far as you can offshore. You want to get down low and approach the shore as if there's fish right there at the edge at the drop-off and start casting when you're 20 yards, 10 yards from the edge. And get down low, get down on your knees or one knee and cast and drop your fly right at the edge and let it fall off the bank. Keep doing that and work that little arc I told you, the 9-3, and then move yourself up a little more. And then when you get up to the edge, keep your profile down low and start casting parallel to the shoreline. Don't cast out, cast parallel. And fish the parallel in a 9-3 arc. You're going to find the majority of your fish on the high tide if you don't just walk up to the edge. You're going to be hanging along those banks, and you're going to get fish there. After you've done that, that's the time to stand up and then start casting and trying to make that 100-foot cast offshore.
Terrific, terrific. I don't know how many times we hear that from our guests about, fishing the edge of a stream or the edge of a lake or the edge of the marsh first, and don't just wade out as deep as you can go because you just walked through all the fish that you probably were going to catch.
Exactly right. It's one of those percentage points things on your list, and if you blow it, you're going to reduce your success rate.
Well, that's great. You just shared just a ton of great tips there, Dave. I really appreciate it. But we've run out of time and needs to close things up here, but stick with us, folks, here, and you too, Dave. We're going to give away a few prizes and before the end of the show, so we'll be right back. And what we're going to be giving away is that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing Magazine, and also a $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers. So stay tuned here, and we're going to do that in just a few seconds. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties.com. That's T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link at the bottom of our homepage in the section on tonight's show that's a what do you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. And for the winners of our drawings, these winners are randomly selected from our show's registration database. So if you didn't register yet, it's too late now. But make sure you do so for our next show so that you have a chance on winning one of these great prizes. So the first thing we're going to give away, and oh, by the way, if you do win, we'll contact you after the show by email and get your information on so that we can get the prize to you. So the first thing we're giving away is one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you want to learn more about the Federation, go to their website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. And you can learn about this great organization that is actually international and deals with salt and freshwater fishing both. So our winner there is Ashik Rahman. Ashik Rahman, New York. So congratulations, Ashik. If you already have a membership, we'll get you that extended, but I know you'll enjoy it, and congratulations. Now, our second prize we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And Fly Fusion is a great magazine. It deals with all kinds of educational topics and has great photographs and articles in it. And our winner there is Brian Daly in Georgia. Brian Daly in Georgia. So congratulations, Brian. So I know you'll enjoy that magazine. For those of you that didn't win, go to the website at flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com, and you can learn all about that that magazine there. So now, Dave, we're going to give away our next gift based upon the correct answer to a question. And I'm going to have you help me make sure I get the right answer to my question.
Sure thing.
We had three flies that you primarily used. That's your stable, your top go-to flies. What are those three flies out there, folks? And give me those free. Oh. Here's my girlfriend writes in, are stripers tasty? Will you cook one for me? So I didn't
they
know
are the
listening.
Absolute best.
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh. Baked striped bass or grilled striped bass is the best.
Yeah, okay. Well, there you go, Julie. Okay, back to our contest here. We've got an answer. It says Bayman Universal, half and half, and the Clouser Minnow. Is that our winner?
That's correct. That's correct. Good job.
Dean Wormel, Westford, Massachusetts. So up in your neck of the woods there. So,
awesome.
Dean, congratulations, and thanks for playing with that. So, the and Dean, what you're going to have to do is write in either in that text box you just used and give us your address and email information, and then we can get that $20 gift certificate. And remember, you can redeem that online in their online show, because online store, because I realize getting from Massachusetts to Colorado could be a bit of a journey. But anyway, be sure to visit Front Range Anglers if you are out here. They've got a great shop in Boulder, Colorado, and they've been supporting our show for a long time. Well, Dave, I really appreciate you being on the show with us again, and a pleasure to talk to you and learn more about striper fishing on the East Coast.
Thank you, Roger.
Yeah, we enjoyed it.
Real pleasure to be here, and it's always great to talk to other anglers and share what I've learned, you know, and I love to hear what other people know as well. You never know it all, and you never stop learning.
That's for sure. That's what's kind of the exciting and fun part about fly fishing is there's always something new to learn. Always a new fish to go after, too. So
right,
I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Folks, remember we have the archive on our website. If you need to look something up, want to learn something about any kind of fish or a location, just try to go to our archive. We have over 155 shows in there right now. And you can search by keyword like the name of a fish, like trout or stripers. You can look up a river, fishery, whatever, a technique, nymphing. And you'll find all kinds of great shows that we've done on this topic. So explore our archive. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. Our next broadcast will be on November 7th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And that show will be interviewing Doug Rose. And our topic for the show will be fly fishing the Olympic Peninsula. Doug Rose is a professional guide in the famed Olympic Peninsula. And he's going to take us through the areas from the rainforest and oyster country to the coast and backcountry. Chinook, chum, coho, pink, and sockeye salmon are all available along with winter and summer steelhead, resident rainbows, coastal cutthroat, and native char. It's like fly fishing heaven, so join us there and learn where, how, and when to fish this beautiful world-class fishery. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Flats Time Charters, and Women's Fly Fishing Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of your shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673 extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673 extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.